Welcome to Celebrate Poe, Episode 40, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. My name is George Bartley, and I'm glad you're taking time to listen to this podcast. This is part two of an examination of William Blake. I want to apologize for the sound regarding Mr. Blake during the last episode. The ghost of Mr. Blake is a new character for this podcast, and there were some problems with the accent. At first, I thought the character of Mr. Blake would have used a very English accent, very RP. But in actuality, Mr. Blake was from working-class London and would have been more likely to use a Cockney accent. I tried to show this, but sometimes the accent got mixed up with Mr. Poe's Southern accent. Actually, there is a bit of similarity between the deep, aristocratic South Southern accent and the aristocratic English accent. This reminds me of the occasion when a casting search was done for the Southern belle Scarlett O'Hara in the movie Gone with the Wind in 1939. The studio looked at thousands of actresses from the southern part of the United States, but the role ended up going to an actress from England, Vivian Leigh. She did a great job in getting across the accent of the Southern legend because not only was she a great actress, but there are more than a few similarities between a Southern accent and an English accent. Old South and England have their classes and forms of aristocracy. Ladies from the northern states at the time, when the movie was being cast, were quite satisfied with the choice, saying at least that they didn't choose a Yankee. Vivian Leigh also won acclaim for playing another classic Southern role, Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire. Now on a different note, after I finished recording the last podcast episode, I spoke with Mr. Blake regarding some of the information he planned to talk about. And let me warn you, it is heavy stuff. Mr. Blake invented worlds with literally billions of characters who were always morphing into other characters, male and female. And sometimes those characters would become entire groups or places or anything you could think of. Later in this episode, we're going to talk about three of the modern-day imaginary worlds, including J.R.R. Tolkien's Hobbits in Middle-earth, C.S. Lewis's Narnia, and the frequently dark medieval world of George R.R. Martin. Gee, I never realized that both Tolkien and Martin had R.R. in front of their last names. Ah, it must be Mr. Poe and Mr. Blake.
Top of the morning, Mr. Bartley.
Top of the morning, Mr. Blake, but where is Mr. Poe?
Oh, Mr. Poe decided to not make an appearance today, to be sure that there was sufficient time to speak with me without his interjections. I think that was his intention.
Be honest with me, Mr. Blake. Is something wrong? Is he hurt or angry?
No, that is not the case at all. Mr. Poe is rather busy and believes that I feel comfortable enough to do a podcast with you by myself, and I do not require his aid.
Well, that's good to know. I was worried there for a minute that he might not want to accompany Mr. Coleridge for our next podcast episode.
Oh, no, there is no need to be concerned. He told me to tell you that he will definitely be here with Mr. Coleridge for your next podcast episode. He is most eager himself to hear Mr. Coleridge's idea about the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. After all, Mr. Poe's only novel, The Adventures of Arthur Gordon Pym, dealt with similar subject matter.
Please sit down, Mr. Blake, and let's jump right into the marriage of heaven and hell, so to speak. First, let me warn the listeners of Celebrate Poe that Mr. Blake's illuminated books deal with material and concepts that are not easy subject matter. So buckle yourself in and stay with us.
Yes, my prophetic works can be a most complex subject. Now, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell was printed as printed sheet from etched plates. Those sheets contained my prose, poetry, and illustrations. Then my dear wife, Catherine, colored those prints. The book opens with a brief poem. Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep. Once meek and in a perilous path, the just man kept his course along the vale of death. Roses are planted where thorns grow, and on the barren heath sing the honeybees. Then the perilous path was planted, and a river and a spring on every cliff and tomb. And on the beached bones, red clay brought forth, till the villain left the paths of ease to walk in perilous paths and drive the just man into barren climes. Now the sneaking serpent walks in mild humility, and the just man rages in the wilds where lions roam. Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep.
Mr. Blake, I wasn't expecting that. Let's start with a very basic question. Who in the heck is Rintra?
Rintra represents the wrath of the prophet. One might say that Rintra is an essential character in my personal mythology. He is later grouped with other spirits of rebellion in the vision of the daughters of Albion. It might be clearer to remember him as the brother of Palambrin or Pity, as well as Bromion or Scientific Thought, and Theotormon, who represents desire and sometimes jealousy. You can think of them as either the sons of Los or of Jerusalem.
Oh, that makes it very clear. That explains everything. So far, your work almost sounds like John Milton's Paradise Lost.
I do believe that John Milton was a true poet, but I believe that in Paradise Lost, Milton was of the devil's party without the writer knowing it. I think it is obvious that Milton believed his Satan was the true Messiah.
I will admit that the Satan of Paradise Lost does come across as the most interesting character. Well, could you tell us a little bit about the physical book itself?
Certainly. I would like to think of The Marriage of Evan and El as basically a prose statement of my philosophic message. The Marriage of Evan and El is the third of my major illuminated books, and I believe only 9 copies still exist. The volume consists of 27 plates with colored illustrations and text.
Illustrations and text. That sums it up nicely. And what was the subject of your work?
One could say that I tried to reverse the traditional notions of good and evil, angels and devils, and Evan and El. Not in a blasphemous manner, but to celebrate the tensions produced by these opposites or contraries. I firmly believed these opposites or contraries or tensions are requisites for progress and creativity.
The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. That's an interesting title. Where did you get the idea?
Mr. Bartley, that is a most interesting story. You see, there was a theologian by the name of Emanuel Swedenborg who lived 33 years earlier. He wrote a book called Evan and El. I was impressed by the grand and mystical conception he envisioned of the world. However, I disagreed strongly with his conventional thinking and tendency to think of the world in completely separate terms of all good or all evil. I believed in a unified vision of the cosmos where the material world and physical desire are equally part of the divine order. In other words, a marriage of Evan and El. The book describes a visit to El.
Much like Dante's Divine Comedy or Milton's Paradise Lost.
Yes, but unlike Milton and Dante, my conception of El began not as a place of punishment, but as a source of unrepressed energy, as opposed to the regulated idea of heaven. I wanted to reveal the repressed nature of conventional morality and organized religion, which I describe thusly. The ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by the names and adorning them with the properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And particularly, they studied the genius of each city and county, placing it under its mental deity. Until a system was formed which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began priesthood, choosing forms of worship from poetic tales. And at length they pronounced that the gods had ordered such things. Thus men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast. Now, Mr. Bartley, in perhaps what has become the most famous part of the book, I wrote a section that I'll call The Proverbs of El. Some may consider them blasphemous in the extreme, but my purpose was very different from the wisdom in the biblical book of Proverbs. The Proverbs of El are deliberately provocative. Their purpose is to cause you to think, to energize thought, to see eternal truths in a new way by visualizing their contrasts.
Can you give us some examples?
Oh yes, I certainly can. Drive your cart and your plow over the bones of the dead. Or, the cut worm forgives the plow. No bird soars too high if he soars with his own wings. The pride of the peacock is the glory of God. And finally, sooner murder an infant in its cradle than nurse unacted desires. Oh yes, and there's one more that I especially like. Prisons are built with stones of law, brothels with bricks of religion. Oh yes, I do like that one.
Oddly thought-provoking.
I believed in a theory of contraries, that without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are therefore necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active springing from energy. In summary, good is heaven. Evil is hell.
Well, that's not difficult to wrap your head around.
No, ultimately, it is not that difficult.
So you're saying that your theory of contraries is actually a belief in opposites.
Mr. Bartley, no, my theory of contraries is a belief that each person reflects the contrary nature of God. It is important to remember that progression in life is impossible without contraries. There are therefore two types of people, the energetic creators or the rational organizers, or as I call them in The Marriage of Evan and Ale, the devils and the angels. Both are necessary to life.
Doesn't the marriage of heaven and hell, or as you put it, the marriage of Evan and Ale, have the lines, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite, for man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern."
Yes, that is from The Marriage of Evan and El, and it is rather impressive that you have committed those lines to memory.
Oh, I like the passage because the doors of perception was supposed to be the source for the name of Jim Morrison's band, The Doors. As you know, Jim Morrison became obsessed with breaking on through to the other side to discover the realms that existed beyond the immediate and the material. And Jim Morrison's music wasn't copyright, then you'd probably be hearing a clip of Break On Through to the Other Side right now. Anyway, Mr. Blake, would you tell us about Jerusalem?
I assume you are referring to the emanation of the giant Albion. Now, emanation means flowing, deriving from a source. For example, if one is referring to physical objects, it could mean water emanating from a stream. Now, are you aware of what Albion means?
I don't know. Maybe Albion is a bird or a sea monster?
Oh, no. Albion is a literary term for England or the British Isles. Jerusalem, or the emanation of the great Albion, is my masterpiece, my last and greatest work. Each copy was etched in handwriting with small sketches and figures and huge illustrations. Some have been even described it as visionary theater. However, only 6 copies were printed during my lifetime, and Jerusalem was all but ignored during my earthly life.
How does it compare in length to your other works?
Oh, Jerusalem is easily my longest single work. Each book had over 100 elaborate pages that had to be individually colored and produced, plate by plate. And I must admit that I frequently change the coloring or text styles, so no 2 copies are exactly the same. Now, Jerusalem does have several passages that have become relatively well known, such as, I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's, I will not reason and compare, my business is to create. But still, I feel that most people might find Jerusalem to be a bit confusing. At first, the characters seem like believable human personalities, but they might expand or contract into persons of the opposite sex, other groups, expand into entire countries, oceans, and even ideas. They might give speeches, but their communication is more like monologues than conversations. Time can be multiple, with moments and eternities each containing the other. It almost seems that the reader must have some kind of understanding of my private perceptions and how I viewed the cosmos.
From what you say, Mr. Blake, it almost seems that Jerusalem is not as much a poem to be read and understood, but literary and visual imagery to be experienced.
Yes, Mr. Bartley, that's very kind and perceptive of you to say. I can attest to the somewhat erroneous belief that many readers might be profoundly unsettled by Jerusalem. And yes, Mr. Bartley, one cannot read and understand Jerusalem the way a person might read Lord Byron or Mr. Poe or almost any other writer. My intention is for the reader to allow the poem and its visuals to wash over the individual until one questions the very grounds of understanding, not just of my work, but of the world.
Mr. Blake, I'm intrigued. Why don't you just go ahead and try and tell me some of the plot of Jerusalem?
Well, I'll make an attempt. Now, one must understand that a character can be a person or a place, and characters can morph into or out of each other. Jerusalem is the emanation of Albion.
You mean a source of Britain? See, I'm getting this.
Well, actually, Jerusalem is a woman, as well as a city, and Albion, as the universal humanity, is a man, and of course a land, Britain. He has or contains 12 sons, who are the 12 tribes of Israel, as well as 4 Zoas. Each Zoa embodies a life principle and has an emanation or feminine figure through which the human can become divine. Now, would you like to hear about the 4 Zoas and emanations?
Well, why not?
First, there is Tharmas, the primal man, who is linked with Enion, an earth mother. Second is Urthona, the spirit of inspiration, embodied in Los, the prophetic artist. Not surprisingly, she is able to forge a city of art in the furnace of Urthona.
Of course.
and in the Thoderman, his emanation weaves beams of beauty.
I would expect nothing less.
And then there is Lover, who is Albion Spectre, while his counterpart, Vala, is Jerusalem's shadow, and Vala eroticizes Woa. And don't forget Urizen, who embodies Raisin. His emanation is the gracious Ahania.
Can't leave out Ahania. She's a good old gal.
Mr. Bartley, I do sense that you are making sport of me. I think I will dispense with the majority of the plot and relate the ending. In the final portion, universal humanity has awoken to forgiveness. Jerusalem realizes the necessity of combining love with wrath. Los sings and Jerusalem appears in several places, descending as a city and as a woman. Los begins to free herself from gender disputes. Then Jerusalem is devoured by a dragon to rise again. Time ends. The breath divine breathes. Albion awakes and sees that Los is Christ, and more importantly, sees that Christ is Los. Albion then throws himself into the fires of Los, which become fountains of living water. The various parts of the Zoas reunite in woas of love, and all things become a great body. The poem Jerusalem can be described as, to use your current vocabulary, a sprawling mental metropolis of good and evil. Now, Mr. Bartley, during the final years of my life, I suffered from bouts of an undiagnosed disease that I called that sickness to which there is no name. I left this earthly life on August the 12th, 1827. Unfinished were watercolor illustrations to John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress and an illuminated manuscript of the Book of Genesis.
Mr. Blake, as I'm sure you know, you may have been largely unappreciated during your earthly life, but you've become a giant in the literary and artistic world of today, and you've inspired countless artists and writers. And please excuse me, Mr. Blake, I tend to get punchy when I'm not getting enough sleep, and I'm sorry that it may have seemed that I was making fun of you earlier.
Well, I have become accustomed to unfavorable reactions. Anything that you may have said is nothing in comparison. No one ever bought my works during my earthly existence.
Things are quite different now. Your works are worth millions of dollars in our present society. And I'd like to recommend that any person with internet access go to www.blakearchive, all one word, blakearchive.org, for the contents of a project started in 1996. This overwhelming project is sponsored by the Library of Congress and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The archive contains high-resolution illustrations of Mr. Blake's original engravings. They are high resolution and will take your breath away. Now, Mr. Blake, I'll be glad to show you this site after the episode is over. I think you'll be most impressed. And I do hope you can come back in the future.
Certainly, Mr. Bartley. And do remember that Mr. Poe will be here for the next episode of Celebrate Poe, along with Mr. Samuel Coleridge, speaking about his masterpiece, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Oh, yes, Mr. Blake, I do have one more question. Could you tell me at what point do the words to Jerusalem appear in the long poem, Jerusalem?
Oh, as I may have mentioned earlier, the lyric to the hymn Jerusalem does have text by me, but music by Sir Herbert Perry. It is not connected to the long poem Jerusalem. The text is actually taken from the preface of another of my prophetic books, Milton, and the words are the national hymn of Britain.
Then, Mr. Blake, could I ask you to read And Did These Feet in Ancient Time?
Certainly, Mr. Bartley. And did these feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. Farewell, Mr. Bartley.
Farewell, Mr. Blake. I know I gave Mr. Blake a hard time regarding his semi-invented world of Jerusalem, kidding him on how confusing and complicated some of his worlds are. But for the last part of today's podcast episode, I want to briefly point out three modern-day, somewhat similar imaginative worlds. Oh, I could go on and on and on, and someday I actually might, about some of the many imaginative worlds in our culture. The term for such imaginative worlds is mythopoeia, that is, myth, think, or mytho, M-Y-T-H-O, mytho, then po, P-O-E, then I-A, mythopoeia. Now, mythopoeia is not used to refer to groups, like groups of Greeks or Romans who designed their mythical stories. Many scholars believe genuine mythopoeia started with William Blake, a fictional or even artificial mythology created by one writer. The writers in this genre usually incorporate mythological themes and archetypes into their fictional works. Remember, William Blake had his prophetic works with the four Zoas and all the different imaginative gods. Perhaps the first person to specifically use the word mythopoeia was J.R.R. Tolkien. His Lord of the Rings had this wonderful world of animals, monsters, wizards, hobbits, elves, and all kinds of creatures in Middle-earth. Then around the same time, another professor at Oxford by the name of C.S. Lewis devised a magical world of Narnia. He later spoke of Christianity as the one true myth. Lewis wrote, "The story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with the tremendous difference in that this really happened." And then, of course, I can't forget George R.R. Martin with his dark stories. He is often called a creator of fantasy for grown-ups and the American Tolkien. Now, sources for this episode include In an Infernal Love and Faith, William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by Robert R. Ricks, Jerusalem and Blake's Final Words, The Context of Blakean Contraries in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by David Stewart, Satanic Mills and Jerusalem Redeemed by Devin Zuber, 30 Great Myths About the Romantics by Duncan Wu, Wild Child, Jim Morrison's Poetic Journeys by Tony Magistrale, The Figure of Jesus Christ in William Blake's Jerusalem, and naturally, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, as well as Jerusalem by William Blake. And check out my podcast website at celebratepoe.buzzsprout.com. Click on the episode you want to learn more about to see show notes and a transcript. And, of course, that URL to the collection of Blake's works. Thank you for making it thus far as we take a deep dive into the life and times and influences of America's Shakespeare and how he has influenced our world. And, of course, influences includes not only the many, many, many literary figures who Poe influenced, but also figures such as William Blake, who influenced Poe. Join us for the next episode in this podcast series, Water, Water Everywhere. Here we will meet the second writer of the Big Six Romantic poets, Samuel Coleridge. This is a favorite topic of mine because it deals with the influence of Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner on Poe's only novel. The closing music for this episode is from Jerusalem.